Hi, welcome to another Writers After Dark. We are here because good stories start with the writers, since wherever there's a story, someone's either making it up or writing it down. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is Diana Rodriguez-Wallach, who is the author of a new, let me see if I get all this right, Latinx YA supernatural mystery called Small Town Monsters. So is it more horror than mystery?
Yes, they are calling it a Latinx horror novel or young adult horror novel.
I like a mixing in mystery in there because it is an exploration of trying to, you know, you have two teens trying to get to the bottom of a mystery that is literally choking the life out of their town.
This is true. Yeah.
So is this your first novel?
No, it's not. It's actually my seventh published novel, but it's very different than my others. My first three books came out in 2008, 9, and 10, and they were young adult contemporary Latina romances. And sort of during that chica lit boom that happened in that era. And then I kind of took a hiatus for a while. I had a couple kids. And then in 2017, I published another trilogy, which was the Anastasia Phoenix trilogy. And that is YA international spy thrillers. So that started with Proof of Lies and Lies That Bind, End of the Lie. And the first book in that series was actually nominated for the International Thriller Awards. So I thought I was going to stick with the thriller vein. I had had some success there. And then this idea popped in my head for a horror novel. And here it is.
So this is your first genre novel in the science fiction supernatural sort of vein.
Yes. Okay. My first dip into that. So I went from contemporary romance to thriller to horror. So it just got increasingly darker as I went.
And they're all mostly teenagers who are the protagonists, your heroes and heroines. And you are definitely putting your two main characters, Vera and Max, through some tribulations in yeah. this particular book. Was there something about the story or just the need to go in the horror vein? How did that jump from thriller to horror happen?
It's interesting because I can say that my inspiration for the book came from a lot of different avenues that sort of all converged to create the story. But my very first spark came from watching the Conjuring film, which I'm sure a million people have seen. It's, you know, the horror movie about Ed and Lorraine Warren, and they are the demonologists who investigated Annabelle the doll and Amityville. But the first Conjuring film, when they are off doing a case, it shows that their daughter is at home in Connecticut and she experiences a haunting herself, because in the basement of their house is this whole museum or a whole collection of occult cursed objects that they brought back from their various cases to keep safe from the world. Right. And I'm watching this movie in my house. I paused the film and I immediately Googled whether they really had a daughter. And they do. And she still lives in Connecticut. Her husband now is the head of the Paranormal Society in New England, and he was the head of the Warren Occult Museum. So up until 2019, you could go to their original house in suburban Connecticut, in a normal looking suburban house, and go into their basement and tour all of these occult objects and see the Annabelle doll and all of that. So I was reading this and I was like, wow, what must it have been like to grow up in that household where not only do your parents have very unconventional careers, they're demonologists, but to grow up in a very Catholic household believing that demons are real, evil is real, and the proof is literally a couple steps away in your basement, and how that must have affected everything, her friendships. I mean, I'm a mom of two little kids. I can't imagine having my daughter sleep over at a girl's house when she's got demonic artifacts downstairs, and how that must have affected everything for her. So the character Vera started spinning in my head at that point of what that must have been like. And then I was sort of hit with another idea of, these are all in just a normal basement. This isn't Fort Knox. Like, what happens if a hurricane hits or a tornado hits and something is unleashed or broken? Like, do the demonic spirits come out? Do they stay in? Like, how does this all work? And so I sort of imagined what it would be like if this evil force was unleashed on an entire small town in Connecticut.
That's awesome. And the idea of assuming that your community, your neighborhood, your home is safe, a safe place to store these, for lack of a better word, dangerous artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, something as simple as, you know, oh, the basement flooded. Oh, there was a fire next door. And, you know, when they were putting out the fire, it, you know, broke open part of our basement. And just
exactly
little normal mundane things that happen and unfortunately end up unleashing hell.
I know. And I mean, the museum was just shut down in 2019. It was shut down by the town. As you can imagine, as the movies got much more popular, more and more people wanted to drive to this little suburban street that doesn't have any parking. It's not a museum, and park on their street and tour these occult objects. And I'm sure the town probably wasn't thrilled with the notoriety, I'd imagine, and eventually figured out a zoning violation to get them to close up shop.
That is unreal. Do you know if they actually opened a commercial location to, because I would think that would be kind of dangerous too, because you have a commercial location, you can have all the security and cameras you want. Someone's still going to try to break in and steal it. Steal something.
And then you have to move it all. Like, how do you, like, think of just moving a piano. How do you move the Annabelle doll? Who wants to touch that? Like, who's coming in and moving this stuff? But I did, I Googled it right before I got on this podcast. So I knew it was going to come up. And so, no, it has not been moved to a new location as of yet. But their daughter's husband is still running the New England Paranormal Society. So he is still very active in the community. I'm assuming he is probably working on it. But as of right now, there is not a location.
That is, it never even dawned on me that that would cause people to go to that place. Because I know people, you know, back in the day, they were trying to, you know, get a site of the Amityville house. I know back when the Da Vinci Code came out, people were flooding all these locations in Europe where the book and the movie had taken place, trying to see if they could crack the code. And people in these little European towns are going, dude, really? Go away.
Oh, absolutely. And I actually started writing the book in 2019 because it takes that long for a book to come out. And at that point, the museum was still open. You could still go. Lorraine Warren was still alive at that point. She hadn't passed away yet. And I said to my husband, I was like, should we go? I don't know. Should we go see it? And honestly, I was raised too Catholic. And I was like, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can risk it. I'm like, what if our elbow brushes up against something? Like, I'm not risking bringing a demon home with us. Like, I'll write it from a distance.
Yeah, it's funny how those familial stories and superstitions, and because like there's a rational part of your brain going, I'm not sure, and then there's the childlike part of your brain that heard your grandma tell ghost stories about being in the cemetery after dark, and those two parts of your brain are fighting, and you end up going, nope, not doing it.
Right? Yes.
Oh goodness. So how did you come up with the scenario that happened in the story? Basically, there's a, I'm not going to go too far into spoiler details, but there's a tragic event that kills mm-hmm. a lot of people in the town that affects all of the children, because all of them at some point had family or close friends who died in the explosion. Mm-hmm. And so you have Max, who's in one clique, Vera, who's in another, but everybody knows who Vera's parents are. And that's what leads Max to figure out that maybe Vera can help. How did those two come about, and the interactions that led up to them working together?
So there were two different areas there. So I mentioned there was a lot of buried inspiration for the book. In terms of the tragic event and the explosion, that sort of came from the idea of what would it take for somebody to turn to the dark side, you know, to make a deal with the devil, that sort of thing. And you would have to be in a very desperate situation. You'd have to be at the very bottom. So there were two different things going on here. One is I had the idea that I didn't just want this to be a traditional exorcism story where it just affects one person, which is pretty common. You know, you have Reagan in The Exorcist. It's just her. You know, the exorcism of Emily Rose. It's just her. I wanted it to affect the entire town. What if the whole town was affected? And at that point that I was writing, cults were very much in the news because of Nexium was being brought up. I had listened to the podcast Uncover, which was the Canadian podcast that really broke that story even before the New York Times, and talked all about the rise of Nexium, which everyone thought was this self-help group that was doing good. They all joined it to better themselves and the world. And it turned out there was this nefarious, horrible underbelly to the organization. And I thought that was an interesting angle on it. So the story just kept widening and widening in my brain. What would it take people to join a cult like this? And part of it in my mind was, what if something tragic had happened and the whole town was grieving and was looking for help and was looking for answers? And at the time, I had had friends of mine who had lost children, sadly, in miscarriage or stillbirth or sudden infant death, and how tragic and horrible those experiences were. And they really affected me. And thinking, when you're at your lowest point, you're praying that you will do anything. You know, you see in most exorcism movies that the big twist at the end is somebody saying, take me instead. And the demon does. And I felt like if you're at your child's bedside in your lowest moment, that is exactly what you're praying, is take me instead. I will do anything. And what would happen if that prayer wasn't being answered by the good place and was actually being answered by this dark force that has, unknowing to you, been spread across the town? Would you still make that deal? And what if the deal was, you'd sacrifice your own life for your kid? I think a lot of parents would make that. But what if the deal was you had to sacrifice other people's lives to save your kid? Would you still make that deal? And sort of trailing that morality line of good and evil, and it's not always as simple as black and white, that it's often a choice that people make to cross the line or not cross the line.
And sometimes that level of desperation is understandable and confounding. You understand how, you know, you want to protect your family, you want to protect, you know, your wife, your kids, your husband, your parents, some cases your grandchildren, and other people are, for the greater good, how can I justify this? This is unconscionable, because you know, if you believe in that level of evil, if you believe that you are talking to a manifestation of evil directly out of the Bible you were raised to believe in, how can you honestly go down that path and still believe that your God will forgive you? And those are questions that I'm like, I want to see somebody in a story fight over that with someone. Mm-hmm. And there's a belief in the faith and the deity associated mm-hmm. with that faith, and you have to wonder,
yeah,
did God do this to test me? If I fail this test and succumb to this temptation, what happens then? And that there's all sorts of things in there. And I love stories that dance along this edge. And you have teenagers who really are, some of these concepts are beyond them in a lot of cases. And they're playing with that fire. And there's a storytelling bravery in that I just adore.
Oh, thank you. And I wanted to also show like the biggest thread that I think I pulled from Nexium was the idea that when these members joined the organization, they didn't know it was up to no good. If you watch any of the documentaries that have been created for the cult, one of the members says, nobody sets out to join a cult. No, nobody says, I'm going to join a cult today. They thought they were joining something good. So I wanted to show that a little bit in the book too, that sometimes they enter into something with good intentions, but eventually they're hearing things that to their logical brain, they know are wrong. They know are absolutely wrong and don't make any sense, but they go along with it anyway. And the other thing that was happening around the same time that I was writing this, it was during the election. It was 2019. It was the run-up to the election. And you were surrounded by all sides with groupthink. Everybody was firmly rooted in what they believed and could not even fathom the other side. And one of the most extreme examples of that was QAnon. And here was this organization that came out that somehow believed that Anderson Cooper was drinking the blood of babies. it makes your logical brain has to tell you that this doesn't make any sense. Yet I had friends that I knew in high school at some point in my life posting on Facebook QAnon theories about Mother Teresa sex trafficking children and Tom Hanks cannibalizing babies. And these are people at one point I knew in real life, and somehow they had been led to believe this and had just let logic out the door. And that was the other thing that I was sort of playing with in here is how do you get that far down the rabbit hole that you will do anything? You will not only make the prayer that I will do anything, but you actually follow through with it.
Yeah, to me, I don't get it. Because the one that sort of surprised me was there were two of them. There was the Pizzagate one, mm-hmm. which absolutely made no sense because, you know, you had a guy drive, you know, 600, 700 miles to free children from a basement, from a building that had no basement.
Yeah. And every time that these incidents were proven untrue, it didn't shake their beliefs. They so believed in this one leader who they had never met, Q, and let it replace everything else in their brains. And every time it was proven false, they still rationalized that it was true.
Yeah, that's the Kool-Aid part that I can't understand. It's like, you have proof here that you have actual scientific, legal, logical proof here that that's not what's true anymore. And how you, like you said, fall down that rabbit hole. I mean, have we raised a generation or three of people who have been so indoctrinated into being right is the only thing that matters? So you're going to hold on to that no matter what?
Yeah,
I mean that. What if someone has a podcast explaining this to me? Let me know.
But it's true what you said about a generation or three, because the other cult I use in terms of inspiration for the cult speak from the cult leader was Jonestown, and that mm-hmm. was a really long. That was back in the '70s, and they literally drank the Kool-Aid. They killed not only themselves, but their children, little babies. This was the largest instance of American deaths ever before 9/11. And it was all because one person told them to, and that's how strongly they believed everything he was telling them.
Yeah, I remember, barely remember Jonestown mm-hmm. when it happened. What was it, 77, 78, something like that?
Yeah.
And I think there were like two or three new documentaries about it over the past 5 years. that really did some more deep dives into getting commentary, opinion, interviews with survivors, with family members of people who died there, getting, you know, more of the story of what led up to them going there. And it's very, very hard to wrap your head around, how did you let yourself get duped that badly?
Oh, I know. No, it is. And it's always fascinated me. I would say if I was looking at the two aspects of the macabre that have always drawn me in, the exorcism and cults were always it for me. The Exorcist is my number one top scariest movie of all time. I don't think it can ever be topped. I still have a hard time sleeping if I even catch a scene of it. And I read the book, and the book is verbatim to the movie. It's fascinating. But then, and cults have always just drawn me in. I can always stop and watch a cult documentary. You know, that's my true crime addiction. And so I got to blend the two together in Small Town Monsters.
How do you think The Omen is scarier or less scary than The Exorcist?
When I was younger, I may have been more scared of The Omen, because when I was younger, I was more scared of creepy kids. But now I have kids, so I can't say that anymore.
It's like, Damien, you've got nothing on my two little ones.
Yeah, sort of like Pet Cemetery with that little boy. You know, that scared me a lot more when I was younger. Now I have to let that go.
Nice. So what was your, trying to figure out how to ask this without going into spoilers, because it is a book I think people will enjoy reading, and I don't want to spoil it for them. The obstacles that Vera and Max run into with the cult members and trying to figure out how to, I guess, break their spell. Mm-hmm. What did you do any research on prayer or spells or, you know, cult deprogramming, anything along those lines that helped you with that?
A little bit. Not to give too much away, but when you get to the end, everything Vera tries to do is wrong. And I think everything she says is wrong before you get to the very, very end. Everything she says and does is wrong. You know, you're not supposed to confront somebody and just say, you're in a cult. You know, that's not the best way to get through to them. So that was based on a lot of research of people trying to deprogram their loved ones from Nexium in particular, because that was the most recent stories that were out there. In terms of the actual exorcism stuff, that was a whole different vein of research and how I could go down that road. Because the Warrens actually do bless their occult artifacts every single week. They went in and blessed them. So I did a lot of research into, like, blessing how? And like, what prayers are they doing specifically? And what do they think that they're doing? So I did a lot of research in that, because it's not your typical just Hail Mary. I can't imagine would bind Annabelle to her doll. So I did a little research on how that might work.
Were there any real life examples that you came across that you went, oh no, I'm not going there?
There were plenty of people who had very detailed, like, exorcism, like, step-by-step guides on the internet, which I can't imagine is something safe for the average person to do. But if you wanted to find it, you could find it. It's there on, like, you know, Joe Schmo's exorcism blog, how to do it, step 1 through 200. So I took all the information I needed from those sources. It was interesting.
And there are still members of the Archdiocese that are certified to investigate claims of possession and trained to deal with those if they turn out to be true. And I can't imagine that their training manuals would be online anywhere.
Not only are there still members, it's actually grown significantly since the pandemic has started. Exorcists are more common now than they were a couple of years ago. The church is actively training more exorcists right now. It's fascinating. And so when I started researching it, obviously exorcisms are most commonly performed in areas with high Catholic populations. So the United States and Latin America are the two biggest areas. Mexico in particular in 2015 had a Catholic cardinal perform an exorcism on the entire country. He was convinced that the whole country was possessed and need to be rid of demons and performed an exorcism to expel all the demons in all of Mexico. So it was just a fascinating vein of research. And if you do see the modern day exorcisms, they don't look like what you see in the movies, you know, with the pea soup and the head spinning in circles. It's almost like somebody going to a psychiatrist's office, like a normal person talking and, hey, how was your day? And then he starts performing the exorcism and then they go almost into a trance like you would see in those, revival tents where people are speaking in tongues. That's sort of what it looks like. There are plenty of documentaries that show that. And it's interesting to see how common and almost how normalized it is in some communities.
Wow. I had not heard the story of exorcising an entire country.
Mm-hmm. And this wasn't a rogue priest. This was a Mexican cardinal. This is, you got to be pretty high up there.
Yeah, yeah. Cardinals are high up in the ranks. Performing an exorcism on a country, that right there is the basis of a short horror movie.
What if that goes wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you do? Does that demon, you know, get expelled into the United States, into Belize, into...
Oh, God. Let's hope not, right? Like, is there anything else there?
Oh, my goodness. So, do you see yourself writing more YA horror? Has writing this book and reading the feedback so far inspired you to maybe do this again?
I definitely think I will. I had a lot of fun writing this book, which is kind of weird because it's creepy and dark, but it was a lot of fun writing. It was a lot of fun researching. I like diving into the psychology behind evil. There was a fascinating TED Talk that I came across when I was doing my research, and it was called The Psychology of Evil. And it was done by the psychologist who did the Stanford University experiments.
Oh, wow.
They made the horror movie about that, mm-hmm. where he took a bunch of really healthy college kids in the 70s and turned one half into prison guards and one half into prisoners, and put them in the basement of the local police department. And he thought it was going to last for 2 weeks. And it was just an observational thing to see what they would do. And it descended into Lord of the Flies. Within 36 hours, kids were having mental breakdowns. And they had to shut it down after 6 days because all of the prisoners were having emotional breakdowns because they were being so abused by these prisoners who were completely healthy, normal college students with no issues. These were good apples, he said. And it was such a fascinating TED Talk to hear. He spent his whole career researching evil, and it almost reminded me of, like, the end result is The Purge, that if you are just given free rein to do whatever you want with zero consequences and somebody else is being held responsible, would you do it? Would you do it? And that is sort of what he was talking about with crossing the line. You know, where do you cross that line? And I think it's a fascinating subject that I could explore for many, many books.
Yeah. Power is a hell of a drug.
Yes. Yes.
Well, we will let people check out Small Town Monsters for themselves. The book is out September 7th.
Yep.
And where can people find you, either, you know, online or on social media to keep track with your next novel?
So I am absolutely everywhere. I have, obviously, there's my website, which is DianaRodriguezWallach.com, but I actually own all variations of my name. So DianaRodriguez.com, DianaWallach.com, it'll all take you to the same place. You could go to buysmalltownmonsters.com or Twitter. I'm at Diana R. Wallach, and Instagram, I'm Diana Wallach Author.
Awesome. We'll have links to those so people can track you down, see what new stories you have planned. But Diana, thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Escape Pod is your destination for the best in modern short science fiction. Our intrepid crew of editors and hosts will bring you fun, thought-provoking in-flight entertainment every week as the pod careens around the multiverse. In the mood for a classic? We've got Anson Mount, also known as Captain Christopher Pike, reading Theodore Sturgeon. Want something a little more up-to-date? Jennifer R. Donahue's Surveillance Fatigue has you covered. In every sense. From classic space opera to intimate character drama. From heroic alien pets waiting for their families to herds of Einsteins and the benevolent conspiracy they're hatching, Escape Pod has it all. Take a ride with us at escapepod.org and buckle up because it's story time.
And again, the story is Small Town Monsters by Diana Rodriguez Wallach, and it is a Latinx teen supernatural slash horror, and well worth checking out. It should be out September 7th, actually no, will be out September 7th from Random House Children's. The imprint, I think, is actually underlined. Either way, the talk about monsters and cults and the unseen long-term damage that is done is a very interesting path to go on, and I don't know, I think fans of conspiracy theories may enjoy this one. It's not quite on the same conspiracy level as, what was it, the other town one, Ghost Tree by Christina Henry. Same type of story, different, way different storytelling styles, both. Equally enjoyable. So how about you? What do you think? Are stories about breaking free from cults, be they human or monsters, the source of their subject? Are those stories you enjoy? Let me know. Send me an email, summer@writersafterdark.com. Come on by the website, writersafterdark.com. Leave a comment along with this episode. Or follow up on Twitter at writeafterdark. That's W-R-I-T-E after dark. Get a conversation started because, you know, chatting about horror, supernatural, yeah, it's one of the types of stories I enjoy. So, yeah, I'll talk about it. You can listen to Writers After Dark on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Player FM. And if you're listening on Apple or Stitcher, please consider leaving us a review. Your reviews, your ratings, all help to raise the profile of this podcast. And that's always a good thing. And if you're a member of Podchaser, you can leave a review or a rating there as well. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently supporting Writers After Dark and all the shows in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your pledges through Patreon, your donations through Ko-fi and PayPal, all of it helps keep these shows online, including Slice of Sci-Fi and the Babylon podcast. All of the shows and websites in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your support helps keep all the podcasts online, all the websites online. So for that, you have my gratitude. If you'd like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi, or you can pick a donation amount over at Ko-fi. That's ko-fi.com/sliceofscifi. I'm still working out how to combine everything, but the Ko-fi page and the Patreon page, supporters will be able to be eligible for perks. I get a lot of TV, movie, and book materials for review around here, and I can't keep all of it. So, supporters through Patreon, donations through Ko-fi, as soon as I have that all entirely online, everyone is eligible to receive those perks. Every month I pick a winner out of the hat, and that person gets to choose from the aforementioned DVDs or Blu-rays or 4Ks or books. And that is my way of thanking you for your support. The theme music here for Writers After Dark is by Sybin Quest featuring Shay Dawn. And that will do it for this episode. See you next time. And remember, keep looking for your own stories.